Hello, this is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. It has been a pleasure to read episodes 1 through 12 of a novel based on my own life in England during and after World War II, entitled 9 o'clock Horses. Episodes 1 to 12 has taken into the lives of an ordinary family in Leicester, England, and their struggles to maintain normalcy in a world of food rationing, bombs dropping almost every night, and the thought that there may be no tomorrow, not for them, or their relatives and friends. Fear and anguish changed their lives forever. In England, it was the beginning of change for women. They had to wear the pants, literally, taking on roles they never expected to play in a man's world of work and employment. They worked in the munitions factories. They took over the manufacturing world of materials necessary for war. When it was over, there was discontent. Rationing was still on. Men who survived the war came home to a new world of debris to clean up on the streets and in their personal lives. Nothing would ever be the same again. I have told this story through the eyes of our protagonist, Amelia Norton, a child born into this world of chaos, World War II. We catch a glimpse of her own views of her family and the inner turmoil concerning her mother's fight to remain sane in a world far from sane. We now continue 9 o'clock Horses when Amelia is on her way to a new life in America. I hope you will continue to listen to each episode on KCIW each week. This is 9 o'clock Horses, Book 2, America. Chapter 13. I remember that long, long flight over the Atlantic as though it happened just yesterday. They do say that you remember old memories more than yesterday when you're older. It's true. On that trip from Heathrow, England, to New York, I sat next to a lady from Kent. I remember her well. Anna Blakely was her name. Never married, around 50 years old, she had spent her whole life as a schoolteacher. Her voice reminded me of my Aunt Grace. She spoke well. Her accent was clipped, precise. She was leaving England to become a nanny in Boston. I really couldn't imagine someone like her living in America with children to educate, but she said it was because she could not stand living in the United Kingdom with things as they were now. It was interesting to hear her views. "Now, isn't it a fact?" she said. "The two world wars ruined England's economy, yes, yes." She tapped my arm. "Of course you are aware that after the war the Labour Party introduced its comprehensive welfare state." She sighed for a moment, seeming to reconsider her words carefully before continuing. "You know, I like the idea of free education," she said. "Old age pensions and the national health system. But of course, changes like that always have an adverse effect, don't they?" I don't think she really expected me to answer because she carried on. "I suppose it was all well and good to have the Bank of England public utilities under the same welfare system, but you see, without private and independent enterprise, people get discouraged. They think they might as well live on the dole. Why work when the government will take care of you? Oh, dear, dear me," she sighed again. "Now we have a 3-day work week and capital punishment is banned. I ask you, what is the benefit of that? No wonder all the power has gone from Britain. Can you believe we've attracted more than 2 million migrants with low numeracy skills to take the place of skilled workers? Yes, yes, it's true." As she went on, I realized how ignorant I was of England's political situation. At that moment, I felt illiterate, and it made me wonder if my naivete would get me into trouble. I decided I was too uneducated to vote anyway. I would be one of those people who are swayed by the media rather than thinking about it and analyzing it on my own. She had pointed out the lights of Boston far below as we flew over. She said a formal goodbye and wished me well. She didn't seem as tired as I felt, and she had another train ride yet to reach her destination, Boston. I was walking into the lounge and saw a man coming toward me wearing a large Texan hat and smoking an enormous cigar. It was Clifford Devereaux. He looked as though he'd just stepped out of an American Western movie. He greeted me in a southern drawl that fitted his image exactly. I could even imagine a gun hanging from his belt. He obviously recognized me by the recent photograph I'd sent to the family, or perhaps it was the tired and bewildered expression of a lost little girl who had just arrived on the plane from Heathrow. To me, at that moment, he certainly didn't resemble the man I'd seen in the photograph, who had appeared much slimmer and was dressed in a tuxedo. His friendliness didn't stop me from being nervous as I sat in the cream leather passenger seat of his Lincoln Continental. It was dusk and we were crawling behind a stream of red taillights along a four-lane highway on the outskirts of New York. I could just make out the dirty snow piled high at the side of the road. When the taillights became less, I knew we were out of the suburbs and in open countryside. We approached a cluster of houses and small shops. Their windows spilled light into the street for a few minutes. Then we were past the houses and out again into the two-lane road, among what I could see in the headlights to be towering pines and fir trees. The clock on the dashboard read 6 p.m. It was past 2 o'clock in the morning for me, still on British time. I couldn't stop yawning. "So, Amelia, this your first trip to the States, huh?" Mr. Devereaux puffed on his large cigar. "Yes," I said. "Thank you for sponsoring me. I really am grateful." "Sure, sure," he patted my knee. "We must get you to the hospital in White Plains tomorrow. Make sure you pass our medical exam." "We'll do that first thing." A large diamond in his pinky ring flashed as he expertly flicked ash into the already full ashtray on the dashboard. I turned my head away as the smell reached me. It lingered in the car, although he did open the window an inch. He drawled on. "Robin, or Mrs. Devereaux, is looking forward to your arrival. We had to fire our last au pair. It sure upset the household for a while." I wanted to ask why she was fired, but decided it wasn't quite the appropriate time to do so. "Of course you will be expected to help Robin with our dinner parties. We do entertain a lot," he said. I could feel my eyes growing heavier as I heard myself saying, "Oh dear, does Mrs. Devereaux expect me to be a chef? I'm not experienced in that." "I'm sure you'll learn," he said. "She's a great cook. Jeremy helps out with the serving." "Who's Jeremy?" I asked. "Oh, he's our butler, chauffeur, general handyman around the house." He suddenly chuckled, almost as though he was going to tell a joke. "He's Scottish, our Jeremy," he said, "and we couldn't understand a word for a few weeks. Even now, I have problems myself with that." For a while, he was silent. I looked out of the window at the ever-changing scenery. Even in the dark, one small town seemed to be joined to another in an endless line of buildings. I had studied the photographs of the family I was about to join. Mrs. Devereaux looked pretty, youngish, with red hair. She was standing by a dark-haired middle-aged man and two boys by the entrance to what looked like an English Tudor-style house. The photograph had obviously not been a recent one, because, unlike the photograph, Mr. Devereaux had white hair. He was talking again in his low drawl. "Now I'm retired, Robin likes to get away on vacation every few months. You'll be there for the children, of course. Richard is 12 and he really needs someone to keep him in line while we're gone." I wondered how old Robin could be if Richard was only 12. My question was soon to be answered as we pulled into a circular driveway of a sprawling replica of an English Tudor-style house. It reminded me of Kilby Manor, just outside Foxby, that was built in the 14th century and converted to a hotel somewhere back in the 20s. Mrs. Devereaux stood tall in the doorway, the sconce lights on both sides of the double doors illuminated her like a model posing for a magazine. She wore beige pants, a matching blouse which shone like silk in the light. A blue cardigan was draped around her shoulders. Her auburn hair swept back into an elaborate chignon, accentuated high cheekbones and sculpted pink mouth. I found myself being scrutinized as I tucked a wayward strand of hair behind my ear. I had recently touched up my dark roots to be sure I would look my best, but I'd lost some of the pins that held my thin, fine hair up in a roll on top of my head. After almost 24 hours of travel, I could only imagine my appearance was not very appealing. The woman offered her hand without smiling. "Have a good flight."
Yes, thank you."
"I didn't realize you were so petite," she said. "We'll have to get some new uniforms for you. The ones we brought for Svida, our Swedish au pair, would hang on you like a sack."
"Uniform?" I queried.
"My girls always wear a uniform, blue, sometimes yellow, and a hat."
"Hat?" I couldn't hide my horror.
"We don't like to find hairs in our soup, you know."
With that, she turned and went inside, leading the way into a dimly lit hall.
"Jeremy will bring your luggage," she added.
As we passed an open door along the hall, I stepped back to look inside the room. A young, blonde-haired boy was lying in front of a TV. He turned to look at me. I smiled at him and said,
"Hello, you must be Richard."
The boy stared at me for a long moment before he stuck out his tongue.
"Nice boy," I murmured to myself as we continued down the hall, through a great expanse of kitchen and up narrow stairs to two small rooms. I had heard Jerry before I saw him coming into the room behind me. His Scottish brogue immediately comforted me. "Whatever can you have in this suitcase? It weighs a ton." I turned to find myself face to face with a tall, slim young man with unruly sandy hair.
"Hello, I'm Jeremy," he said.
I reached for his hand. "Pleased to meet you." Robin Devereux settled herself on the small brown couch. Jeremy, on his way out, winked at me.
"See you later," he said.
I knew I had at least one friend.
"Now there's just a few more things we need to sort out," Robin said, crossing her legs and leaning back. "Just a few."
"Excuse me, Mrs. Devereux," I said. "I know it might be inconvenient, but would you mind if I made myself a cup of tea? It might wake me up a bit."
Robin's face flushed as she sat up straight, uncrossing her legs. "We only have herbal teas in this house, and I'm not about to cater to your English whims, dear. I do hope you understand that."
I sat down on a chair opposite her.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I'm just so tired. It was a long flight."
All at once, I felt dowdy and plain in front of this well-put-together woman. My confidence was evaporating.
"The quicker we get to the rules of the house, the better," she said.
"Then we can get on very well together."
Robin leaned forward. Her intense brown eyes held my attention.
"I do not want you to fraternize with Jerry in his apartment, which is at the other end of the house, not even during the afternoons after your duties," she hesitated. "Or any other time. Is that clear?"
I wanted to ask why, but thought better of it. Robin was continuing.
"I have a few more things to say, and then you can go to sleep. This is a comfortable apartment for you, isn't it?"
I looked around. The living room was rather sparse, with a small table, two chairs, a couch. The bedroom, with a single bed and its bright yellow quilt and nightstand, looked comfortable. Anyway, I could not imagine my time in the living room would be limited. The bathroom was small, with no bathtub, but what could I expect? I was a maid.
"It's fine," I said. "Thank you."
Robin sighed before she continued.
"Clifford Sundet Canyon is back from skiing in Europe. He'll be coming by to see us, no doubt, very soon."
She rose from the couch and went to stand by the window. After a moment, she pulled the blind down and turned to me. Canyon is a very attractive man. He tends to flirt with young women. It would be to your advantage if you were not overly friendly toward him. She sounded so serious, I just stared at her. As you say, Mrs. Devereaux, I finally managed. Robin flounced to the door. She stood in the doorway, her back to me. I'll have a list of your duties for each day taped to the fridge. Clifford is taking you to White Plains to the hospital tomorrow, where you'll be examined by our own doctor. Then he'll take you to the uniform shop in town afterwards. We must get you properly fitted out, she turned to me. Mustn't we? I didn't think the question was directed to me, so I said nothing. We usually start our day at 7, she said, so if you could make a note of that, I'd appreciate it. She smiled. You sleep well now. Good night. When she left, closing the door softly behind her, I went to the window and lifted the blind. I looked out. Darkness enveloped the grounds except for a patch of light that shone across a lawn directly across an open doorway of another building close by. I opened the window and listened to the soughing of the wind in the trees. It sounded like the sea, and I was reminded of my time in Brighton at the TB Sanitarium. I closed the window, took off my shoes and lay back on the bed, relishing the stillness after the hustle and bustle of a long day. Tomorrow, I decided I would talk to Jeremy. The scenario that Robin had presented to me was intriguing. What exactly was going on in the Devereaux household? Who I could fraternize with and who I could not was quite a mystery. But with little energy left to think about it at that moment, I washed my face in the tiny bathroom sink, found my nightdress, and slipped between the clean sheets of the single bed. When I woke, it was still dark. It took me a minute to realize I wasn't at home in my own bed at Art Olive's in Foxby. I fumbled for the light switch. My small travel alarm clock I'd set on the bedside table read 4:20. The house was quiet, except for the hum of what I suspected was the central heating. I suddenly felt very much alone. What was I expecting to find here, 3,000 miles from England? At that moment, I questioned my own sanity. The reason was, I said to myself over and over, was to know more about Vietnam, to be closer somehow to Colin, to find out where he was. I had to think positively about the whole thing, I realized. The room was stiflingly hot, and I went to the window to open it wide. I was not used to heat in a bedroom. In fact, the 2 radiators my aunt had recently installed were in the hall and living room only. One wouldn't think of heating a bedroom, she'd said. Everything was pitch black outside, not a shred of light anywhere. I listened again to the soft soughing of the wind in the firs. I knew I wouldn't sleep any longer. Jet lag would be a problem for a few days. My timing for sleep was all off. I opened my suitcase and dumped everything on the sofa. I found my airmail writing pad and envelopes, sat down to write to my parents, Aunt Olive and Colin's mother. I told them about my long trip over the ocean, the lady I'd met on the plane, the trip from the airport, and what I knew about the Devereaux family so far. I had been writing to Pauline in Africa on a weekly basis. Considering it sometimes took 5 weeks to reach her, the news was sometimes out of date, but she wanted to know what I was up to. She had 3 daughters now, and it surprised me when she said she was expecting again. When I realized the dawn had crept through the room without me being aware of it, I went to the window yet again. All I could see were trees, so different from the smokestacks of the factories at home, and the grey smoke that blocked the views of hills that I had been told were there. This was paradise. I took my first shower. I wasn't sure I liked the water spraying on me, but once I got used to the wonderful warmth, I could see how it was that had made an impression on Colin. I dressed in my new sweater and shirt, nylons and flat shoes. When I went downstairs to the kitchen, I found Robin making breakfast, apparently for me. I was prepared to be ordered to help in the kitchen, but it wasn't to be, not that day. The scrambled eggs were served with lox, bagels, and cream cheese. Delicious. I'd never tasted lox before. It had been many hours since I'd eaten anything, perhaps why it all tasted so good. Robin didn't attempt conversation with me. In fact, once she'd set the plate in front of me, she left the kitchen. It was obvious she was not about to be friends with me, but I didn't care. Everything was different for me. The herbal tea in tepid water really was awful. But that was to be the very least of my worries in the future. This is Angela Ewing with Curry Coast Community Radio. Thank you for listening. Please tune in next week to episode 14 of 9 O'Clock Horses.